You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
And finally, and we've got two finalies for you, I want to give you a really interesting update on the Sky Global, also known as Sky ECC. I talked about this on my last radio show, and it is interesting. Now, 2 weeks ago, if you don't remember, Belgium police said that they had cracked over half a billion messages on Sky ECC phones. These are phones that are designed for heavy encryption. They have their own ecosystem. They're designed for maximum privacy. So basically, Belgium police said they cracked over half a billion messages on these ECC phones and made dozens of arrests of suspected drug traffickers and other criminals that were using these phones. And so Sky ECC at that time came out and said that their phones were actually not hacked, that somebody was selling copycat or counterfeit ECC phones. But as I mentioned last week, with half a billion messages hit and the police declaring that they were watching these live, and with over a billion messages actually taken, not just decrypted, that's the half billion, there's no way. It's got to be Sky ECC. And of course, I was right. This week, or I should say last week rather, they are basically out of business because the U.S. Department of Justice just released this about a week or two ago. And I quote, Sky Global executive and associate indicted for providing encrypted communication devices to help international drug traffickers avoid law enforcement. Now, the indictment alleges that Sky Global installed sophisticated encryption software in iPhone, Google Pixel, BlackBerry, and Nokia mobile phones. Sky Global device users then communicate with each other in a closed network, and Sky Global routes these communications through encrypted servers located in Canada and France. There are at least 70,000 Sky Global devices in use worldwide, including in the United States. And the indictment alleges that for more than a decade, Sky Global had generated hundreds of millions of dollars in profit by facilitating the criminal activity of these transnational criminal organizations and protecting these organizations from law enforcement. So here's my concern with this. Having strong encryption in and of itself does not make one a criminal, nor should selling devices with strong encryption on the device also make you a criminal as well. I am not part of any criminal enterprise, at least that I know of, but I am a privacy advocate. You've probably heard me preach about privacy and encryption all the time on this show. A phone from Sky ECC prior to this mess, before all of this was discovered, would have been very appealing to me to get. So this all comes down to intent. Here, though, is where I think Sky Global diverged, and this is the crux of what they're being charged with. And I quote, basically, once again, the indictment alleges that Sky Global employees use digital currencies, including Bitcoin, to facilitate illegal transactions on the firm's website to protect its customers' anonymity and to facilitate the laundering of customers' ill-gotten gains. According to the indictment, Sky Global employees also set up and maintained shell companies to hide the proceeds generated by selling its encryption services and devices. So obviously, they definitely cross the legal line here, but this is my concern with this whole thing. We have an ongoing tug of war between privacy advocates such as myself and governments, not just the United States, that want to weaken or get rid of encryption so that their law enforcement can easily walk into any device. This issue here is going to be used as a bludgeon, at least in the United States, by law enforcement to underscore why encryption should be weakened or simply made illegal. Society tends to be reactionary and create laws for the lowest common denominator. And so the vast majority of us are not criminals. You and I listening here, we're not committing crimes, maybe outside of a speeding ticket. So why ruin privacy for all of us? That's the problem that I think we're going to have here. That's what Sky ECC is bringing to light. This put them out of business for obvious reasons. They lied. And then they lied about basically hiding and laundering money, and they're going to get their day in court. We'll see what happens. And with that, we have one more finally, and we're going to be talking about a single IT contractor, an employee. And I think this is an interesting one. It really needs to be underscored. The person we're talking about is a man named Deepanshu Kher of India, and he was sentenced on March 22nd of this year in federal court he's sentenced to 2 years in prison for accessing the server of a Carlsbad, California company and deleting over 1,200 100 of the company's 1,500 Microsoft user accounts or Microsoft Office 365 mailboxes. Now, according to court documents, Kerr was employed by an IT consulting firm from 2017 through May of 2018. And in 2017, basically, this firm was hired by this company to assist with their migration. And so they sent Kerr. Now, the company was dissatisfied with Kerr's work and relayed this dissatisfaction to the consulting firm, basically, you know, after Kerr's arrival and the work that he did. So in January of 2018, the consulting firm basically pulled Kerr from this company. And a few months later, on May 4th of 2018, basically, he was fired. And then a month after that, in June, he returned to India, where he's originally from. Now, here's where it gets interesting. On August 8th of 2018, 2 months after his return to India, Kerr basically hacked into the Carlsbad company server and deleted over 1,200 of their 1,500 mailboxes. And I think that he probably just kept the usernames and passwords or remembered them. Nobody bothered to change them, and here we are. Now, this attack affected the bulk of the company's employees and completely shut down the company for more than 2 days. As the company's vice president of IT explained, the impact was felt inside and outside of the company. Employee accounts were deleted. They could not access their email, their contacts, their meeting calendars, their documents, corporate directories, video and audio conferences, the Teams environment, which basically is like a communications platform. Basically, they couldn't do anything out of their jobs. They were completely dependent on this ecosystem, which also underscores another problem that we have on dependency on one simple provider. Now, outside of the company, customers, vendors, and consumers were actually unable to reach employees because the employees were unable to reach them. They didn't have mailboxes. So if you sent them a mailbox, you'd get a message that says this employee doesn't exist. Nobody could inform their buyers or their customers what was going on because nobody could get access to the contact lists, and they couldn't tell people when they were going to be operational again. So, unfortunately, and to continue, even after those 2 days, the problem still remained. Employees were not receiving meeting invites or cancellations properly. Employee contact lists could not be completely rebuilt. The affected employees could no longer access folders that they previously had access to, which stops them from working. And this company repeatedly handled just a ton of IT problems for 3 straight months. And their vice president of IT closed his entire interview by saying, and I quote, "In my 30 plus years as an IT professional, I have never been part of a more difficult and trying work situation." That's crazy. And in pronouncing the sentence, U.S. District Court Judge Marilyn L. Huff noted that Kerr perpetrated a significant and sophisticated attack on the company, an attack that was planned and clearly intended as revenge. In addition to the 2 years in custody, Judge Huff sentenced Kerr to 3 years supervised release, and he has to pay restitution to the company to the magnitude of $567,000 $567,084. That is basically the amount that the company had to actually pay to fix the problems which were caused by this guy. And this, I think, underscores a couple of different things. Aside from the dependency on ecosystems or a single ecosystem with, let's say, no real solid backup for restoration, here we have a problem where we don't have good discipline to, let's say, change passwords after somebody is terminated, which is a huge thing. That should be part of a good process. Otherwise, something like this might happen. But I think it also speaks to making sure that we teach ethics and morality and that we have got good people, that are adhering to those kinds of things. And that's a harder one to weed out because you might trust somebody that you shouldn't. Humans trust even when we shouldn't. But, you know, I equate this with the work that I've done with various universities spinning up cybersecurity or cyber warfare programs. One of those things I always insist on is basically an ethics and morality class being taught to students. If you're going to graduate black belts in hacking, you better make sure they're on our side. That's a huge problem. They need ethics and morality. So those were your breaches of the week. It has been absolutely bonkers. Were you affected? Let me know, and let's move on.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And now for the deep dive segment, where we take a closer and deeper look at a cybersecurity, cyber warfare, or technology issue around us. And if you have any suggestions for a deep dive segment or something you'd like me to dive into, you can once again find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A. ESP. Again, that's Nick A. ESP. Or you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. That's questions@securityfanatics.com. I am more than happy to take a look at it. And if it meets our standards, we are more than happy to do a deep dive on it. So let's begin.
And if I'm being honest here, I think this deep dive is probably one of the most important deep dives I have ever done on the radio, and it's probably one of the most important deep dives I will ever do, given the current state of this situation. And this is simply titled, The Next Frontier of Data Privacy, Your DNA. And we're going to be talking about this. Now, this actually stems from an article that I wrote for Michael Smirkanish of CNN. He's on Sirius XM as well. And he has a website, smirkanish.com, that I write for. And other really interesting people, I think, have really written there, including Arnold Schwarzenegger and some other people as well. And so basically, this actually landed me a segment on his show. And I think it's just so important that I wanted to bring it to my audience as well. And what we're talking about is you basically, you know, taking a swab or spitting into a tube and sending it off to a for-profit DNA company. And let's dive in, because while we hear about all of the pros in this, we almost never hear about the cons, and that is the data privacy side of this. And so my goal here, just so you understand, isn't to prevent you or anyone from sending away your DNA for any reason that you see fit. This is purely to inform everybody to make an informed decision about essentially an irreversible choice in your life. Now, if you think about it, every single day we take risks. We get into a car and we drive knowing that we could get into a car crash. We walk down the street knowing that we could possibly get hit by a bus. We even use our credit cards when we're shopping, whether we're online or in person, and we simply assume that the companies will securely handle our credit card information in the era of data breaches. Now, most of the time, we don't think about these risks. We've learned to basically, you know, just ignore them. Our experience tells us that odds are we're not going to get into a car accident every time we drive. However, there are other more serious risks we fail to realize or even take into consideration before making a critical life decision. One of those choices in life is intrinsically tied to us from the moment we are conceived to our inevitably and hopefully peaceful death, who we give our DNA information to. Now think about this. Millions of people, about 23 to 30 million people by the estimates that I found, have basically swabbed a cheek or spit into a tube and sent their DNA to various private corporations in exchange for things like a deeper look into their family history, possibly more insight into health risks that your genetic code may reveal. And it's really exciting to find that long lost family relative. And it can honestly be a relief to know that basically a propensity for cancer doesn't run in the family. However, most of us don't realize the risks associated with giving away what is uniquely and intrinsically ours to a for-profit corporation. And so with that, I put together four critical points or factors that basically you should understand before you decide to send in your unique DNA to one of these corporations. This is the side of the DNA business they really don't tell you about, and so let's start with that. The first thing is that we are living in the era of data breaches, or the era of criminal hackers. Corporations are declaring data breaches left and right, and DNA companies are no different. You know, for example, if the end of 2020, the beginning of 2021 has shown us anything in terms of technology, it's that we are indeed living in the era of the data breach. At the end of 2020, and you've heard me talk about this on the radio, SolarWinds, a provider of IT management software to massive corporations, was breached by, you know, all indicators pointing to Russian hackers, which forced many Fortune 500 companies and government agencies in the United States to declare data breaches. DNA companies are not immune from these as well. In 2018, MyHeritage DNA out of Israel suffered a massive data breach that exposed the personally identifiable information of 92 million of their users. Now, fortunately, MyHeritage claims that while all of this information was stolen, their DNA database was separate and not taken, and that's good. But in 2019, DNA testing company VitaGene exposed the genealogical data on thousands of its members. this is what we're talking about here. And as you're putting, as you're giving this unique code to this corporation, if they get hit or breached, your code could get out there and be sold to God knows who. Illegally obtaining a person's DNA can have some disastrous consequences if you weren't aware. Imagine if that data falls into the hands of a health insurance provider who is able to review the DNA and then increase their premiums based on what they find. And I will talk about this more in a future point. Believe me, I will. Or think about this, having the DNA of a population fall into the hands of an adversarial government that could use that data in some manner. And in the era of genetic engineering with technologies like CRISPR, CRISPR, losing control of your data to a corporation can have some very serious negative consequences in your life, which brings us to the second point. Corporations that have your DNA may be purchased or simply give your DNA to other entities. Now, imagine giving your biological footprint away to a DNA testing company for the purpose, the sole purpose of finding a family member around the world or family wherever it is, only to have that DNA company enter into an agreement with a massive pharmaceutical corporation to use your DNA for study. That is exactly what happened between the DNA testing outfit 23andMe and GlaxoSmithKline, one of the largest pharmaceutical corporations on the planet. In 2018, GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, purchased a $300 million stake in 23andMe and entered into a partnership to share DNA from 23andMe for their testing. Overwhelmingly, most people do not read the fine print when they sign up for virtually anything online, including 23andMe. However, in this case, the more recreational users that tend to use companies like 23andMe either didn't realize or didn't understand that their data could be used in this manner. Furthermore, the concept of your genetic information being shared between companies only exacerbates the basic stated risk that I just talked about of hacking. If your DNA data was also copied into a different infrastructure, into a different company with a different set of security controls, it could possibly be vulnerable. 23andMe also recently went public in February of 2021, which means that anybody can purchase a stake in the company that has basically the DNA information on you and millions of people. Imagine Amazon or Facebook buying 23andMe or a majority share. Or how about an adversarial government bent on dominating the biomedical field? That is China, who has stated that. What if they purchase a controlling interest in one of the largest DNA sites on the planet? That's a huge, huge problem. We don't think about this. And if you think, well, you know, we have laws in the government, let's talk about point number three that I'm about to make, because many U.S. privacy laws in regards to DNA are antiquated or they're not comprehensive. DNA privacy is in that vein. And when it comes to privacy laws, the federal government of the United States is years behind other governments, like the European Union, for example, and even some of their own states. Such as California, have more advanced privacy laws than the federal government. So, for example, because many of the privacy laws actually surrounding things like location privacy were essentially written in the Reagan era in the 1980s, for years, law enforcement could use companies like LocationSmart to access the GPS location of your smartphone in real time without needing a warrant. And I have done a lot on LocationSmart and LocationSmart competitors about this. If you think about HIPAA, which is the healthcare privacy law, the U.S. federal law basically for health patient privacy, it does not cover direct-to-consumer products such as home paternity tests, fitness trackers, health apps. In other words, you've got a smartwatch and you are giving all this data to that app, putting it to the cloud. That is not covered under HIPAA, and DNA testing companies are not covered either. And if you're thinking, well, wait a second, we had a DNA law passed under Obama. Let's talk about that, because the Genetic Information Non-Disclosure Act, or GINA, which was passed in 2008 under the Obama administration as an attempt to modernize DNA privacy, has a ton of loopholes that fall short of allowing you to have total privacy with your DNA. GINA only applies to health insurance and employment agencies, or employment, basically your employer. And basically, there was that's it. There was even an attempt to weaken those restrictions in 2017. And furthermore, if an insurance company somehow gains access to your DNA via basically a roundabout way, another means, they could indirectly match that DNA to the profile and circumvent the law. And in this vein, with life insurance companies, it's happening right now. Life insurance companies do not fall under GINA, and so they have the right to ask for your direct-to-consumer genetic testing if they know you took it, which also means they can decline coverage if the person refuses. And if you think about this, if you look at the state of New York, New York is allowing life insurance companies, this is law in New York, you can go read this, New York is allowing insurance companies essentially to data mine you through Facebook and other social media platforms that they can get access to essentially make sure that you are telling them the truth. So in other words, if you go to your insurance company and say, yeah, I lead a pretty normal life, you know, I'm not into anything extreme, et cetera, and then they go to your Facebook page and they see you jumping out of airplanes and rock climbing and all this kind of stuff, they can basically say, you lied to us, therefore we will not honor your policy. They have that ability to information share, which means when you are looking at something like GINA and they are asking you to say, we don't fall under this, we have a right to ask for your genetic testing results, what is that going to do to your life insurance premiums, especially even if you don't have symptoms, maybe your family does have a propensity for cancer. That's what we're talking about here. And that also brings up another issue, because what happens if your cousins do this or whatever? And my fourth point is that you're not the sole owner of your DNA. You own it with your family. And when Michael Smirkanish of CNN SiriusXM that I mentioned originally was talking about this, he mentioned on the air, he's like, Nick, this is what I was talking about. I made the calculation that, well, my cousins have done it, and so I'm already in the database. And you're not really. Now, think about this. So even if you're not partaking in the DNA ancestry aspects of these private corporations, your genetically related relatives most likely are. When your cousin sends in his or her DNA to one of these companies, a part of your DNA goes with it. And so this doesn't identify you directly since you don't have the same parents, but you are related, which could basically get you into trouble. Now, the most glaring example of this out there that made news a couple of years ago was the Golden State Killer. Using a website called GED Match, which was essentially designed for DNA matching, law enforcement was able to run the Golden State Killer's DNA and find a match to a relative of his, thus allowing them to essentially zero in, arrest him, and convict him. Now, don't get me wrong. Nobody's going to deny, including myself, that finding and locking up a serial killer is a good thing. But this situation brings to light a serious issue that both the public, you and I, and the law of the U.S. government must deal with. We have no right to be forgotten with this kind of data, since we are tied to our family. Your family members may have given you no choice but to always be known simply by accident of birth, and that is a serious issue that must be addressed. This is basically it. Until the public has basically these protections, we are in jeopardy. And so with that, we can talk about what we need to do to actually create and enforce this. Because if we are able to turn this ship around, we can do this with more security and guarantees under the law. And so as I'm looking at this, as I wrote and I'm talking about this, the first thing we need to do is enforce strict data security laws that ensure our DNA is constantly behind layers, not one layer, layers of strong encryption, which is tested and confirmed through third-party audits from these corporations. In that way, if an attacker is able to, let's say, get into basically steal this DNA database, if they break into like a 23andMe or whoever, that is behind multiple layers of encryption, and therefore your DNA information can't be accessed. There is no requirement to do that right now. The next thing I think we need to do is create consent laws that corporations must adhere to when they enter into agreements with other organizations. So for example, when 23andMe partnered with GlaxoSmithKline, all 23andMe users should have been given the right to refuse to have their data used, seen, or transferred from 23andMe to GlaxoSmithKline. Also, if another third party requests DNA information, such as a life insurance company, you should have the right to, one, be informed that that is a request, and you should also have the ability to decline. There should be no loopholes in the law that allow a life insurance company or any other entity to circumvent the 2008 GINA law and do this. I also think we need to create and enforce a right to be forgotten. This is beyond important. This needs to be for all citizens, and this has to extend to DNA. Essentially, if you choose to be forgotten, it would be illegal for a DNA matching service to link you to your relatives or for you to be identified in any way with them genetically. While this may have possibly helped somebody like the Golden State Killer, at the end of the day, the vast majority of us are not that, so we should not be talking about the lowest common denominator here. But if for whatever reason you say, I never want to have my DNA run, you should basically, there should be some kind of registry, or you can go to these database companies and say, I am this person and I do not want to be identified in any which way, shape, or form. And I think that is a beyond important ability that other countries or organizations such as the European Union have given their citizens. If an EU citizen right now, let's say I'm hosting Facebook and they go to Facebook and say, I want to be forgotten, Facebook is required under EU law, not just to delete them from the system, but to erase their existence from that system. No backups, no nothing. And if they are caught, that is huge fines and repercussions.
And thank you so much for tuning in this week. It was another fun show, and I think we covered a lot of really good stuff. And I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. It was a really good time, and I hope you keep tuning in. Thank you very much for listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show here with Nick Espinoza. And if you have any comments, suggestions, questions, absolutely anything, once again, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A ESP. Again, that's Nick A ESP. And you can always send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. Don't be shy. I love the feedback. We've been having a great time with the show. And as always, stay safe and stay online, everyone. Thanks for listening.